Welcome to Salvation by Grace, a broadcast ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. For more information, we invite you to visit our website at www.salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Most of the email I get is questions. The vast majority of it is questions. People asking for input, theological things, and that is why I am so far behind on my email. I am really way behind. But I also get a lot of just real good positive email that I like to share with you all every once in a while, just so that you know that this internet thing we're continuing to do continues to bear a tremendous amount of fruit. I am constantly amazed at our internet outreach. A year ago or so, Jeff and I just stopped tracking the numbers. For a couple of reasons. One, it was just very impressive numbers, and from month to month, it just kind of stayed impressive. So what's the point of figuring out whether it was an up or down month? And secondarily, we do believe that in God's absolute sovereignty and providence, He's going to bring exactly who He intends to bring. And they're going to come across our website precisely when God intends that they will come across our website. So people continue to find us on the website. I think we've been up there for so long that sometimes we sort of feel like, well, we've kind of gathered our group. But people continue to find us all the time, and it amazes me. And I am supposed to tell you all, first off, our friend in India who has the lending library over there, I just got an email from him this morning asking that I say hello to all of you.
Hello.
So hello to all of you. This week I got another email from our friend in Nigeria saying, I'm still here and I'm still listening. Just wanted to let you know I was still out here. And you know, there are people scattered around the planet who week by week tune in and listen to us. It's quite amazing. And then I got this one. By way of introduction, my name is, and he gives me his name. I live in Alexandria, Louisiana. I want to share with you my praise of God for how He is using your internet ministry to help continue the process of education and sanctification in my life. I've been downloading your books and messages for 2 or 3 weeks now, brand new, and took the time to write after 2 or 3 weeks. Where are the people who have been listening to 4 years and haven't dropped me an email? We don't know you're out there unless you tell us you're out there. I was really glad to hear from this fella. He said, I download your messages and listen to them at work and while I'm walking my dog. I'm a fairly new Christian, and over the last several months, God has put a hunger in me to learn more about Reformed theology. Thank you for the meals. Now, that's why we do what we do. Yep. Why are we out there spending the time and the effort and the money to keep that website going? Exactly because of emails like that. Then last week, I stepped aside from our study in Acts and decided that we would just talk about prayer for a while, and the response to that has not only been overwhelming here locally. I've had a couple of members of the congregation here call me during the week and just say thank you and just say how much they enjoyed it. And some, I go, hey, well, do you click? And they're gone. That's all they wanted to tell me was thank you. I sure enjoyed that. This email is from a listener out in California, and it starts, remember I told you that there was a war cry going from the group in Iowa, next year in Smyrna. Well, this listener in California started her email off, next year in Smyrna. Dear Pastor Jim, never in my life have I felt so connected to a group of people as I do to you and the congregation there in Smyrna. She's in Southern California. And because of what we're doing on the internet, the way we do it, so interactive, responding to questions, answering people's email, putting up messages twice a week, they feel more connected with us oftentimes than any local church they can find because we're just more personal. And we're actually teaching genuine biblical theology. And boy, I get a lot of email from people saying, I'm so glad you're there because there sure aren't any churches around me teaching. The messages from Elder Barney Johnson, the reading and the prayer by Pastor Tyndall were so personal, so full of Christian love, honesty, understanding, and compassion that I have listened to them over and over. See, that's why we get Barney Johnson to come talk to us. That's why we get Pastor Tyndall to be a part of our celebration on the weekends when we all get together from around the country, because people need to know that there are other folk out there teaching and believing the same thing we teach and believe other people talking about the same God and the same Christ and the same gospel. It rings through. People can hear it in their voices. Each time I listened, Pastor Tyndall's prayer to God that he would open our ears and that we would hear dear brother Barney, each time it struck me deeper and deeper into my heart and into my mind. I did not grow up nor live most of my adult life knowing much of anything about prayer. Elder Johnson's two deer on the sign and how he prayed to God to give him a sign about what to do was such a personal, reflects such a personal God, such an elder brother in Christ, that these concepts are filling a hole in my heart that has been empty for a long, long time. Isn't that something?
Praise the Lord.
And then, this morning, I clicked on the message from yesterday morning. I am overwhelmed. And even though I am 1,994.63 miles away, did the math. Even though I'm that far away, I can weep as you tell about tucking your children in and praying with them. I can see the lady who went to the sick man and prayed for him while everyone else was calling for the paramedics. The loaves of bread that arrived at 10 o'clock at night. I'm touched in such a deep personal place that I know I must be in the hands of an all-sovereign God, amazing and unbelievable as that may be. So see, the stories that you all shared last week are resonating. You thought I'd edit those out? No, never. Never. Those were such wonderful personal testimonies and stories, and look at how they've resonated in the hearts and minds of other folk. I love your teaching. I love that the all-sovereign God is the only God that makes any sense at all. I agree with that statement completely. I did my years in organized religion with a God that was way too small and way too powerless, and yet they kept talking about him being on a throne, and somehow he was almighty in some limited sense. He had this sort of limited almightiness. And they had this sort of God that they could drag out and use whenever they needed him, but he didn't seem to be in charge of anything. And then I started finding out that the God of the Bible is in absolute sovereign control of the events and the purposes that happen in his creation, and that was an enormous relief to me to find out, because life made sense. Everything had purpose. Things that happen according to his goodwill and pleasure and plan. And man, that just took this load, this burden of years and years of organized oppressive religion off my shoulders. And the only God I've ever come across that makes sense is the sovereign one. Anybody in here want to testify?
Amen.
Yeah, I thought perhaps.
But while me and Mom were driving our way over here, oh, we saw the sign next to the church. I know this will be edited, but I just...
you don't know that.
I don't know that. Okay. But we saw the church down the street that said, "Did you leave God? He's still waiting for you." And we talked about how God was so dependent of us, this sovereign God, dependent on the earth. Like, "Oh, don't need God, please come back to him." And I just stated in the car, you know, everybody in the other churches just says that God's dependent on us, when really, he loves us because he wants to love us. I mean...
You got it. You've said it. No, yeah. You're good. Okay, you're good. I'm just going. Stop right there and you're good.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. God loves us because he wants to love us. That's it. Once you said that, you wrapped it up.
Yeah.
Yes. Cool is the word.
Yeah. Right.
He loves us because he wants to love us. So was that the Methodist church up here? You know, we've talked for a long time about getting a sign to put out here in front of our church. And the only reason that we talked about it, jokingly, but the only reason we've talked about it is to answer the church up the street. So that when people are driving down the road and they read the signs in front of the Methodist church, they can come another couple blocks and we will reply to their sign. The problem is that most weeks... our entire reply would consist of, and so we...
if they're heading the other direction, you'd hear first. It's like, wait till you hear this baloney.
Yes. Exactly. I'm never going to get through these emails. Yes.
As Pam mentioned recently, along with a proper view of God, which is most helpful, as you mentioned, is also a proper view of man.
Mm-hmm.
And when we realize we're not as big as we think we are, that takes a lot of pressure off of us, too.
Right. Yeah. Oh, when I discovered and became convicted of the reality biblically that I could not save myself, that was actually a relief for me, because I spent so many years in that really oppressive religion that said, you got to do it, and you got to do it enough, and you got to do it constantly, and you got to do more, and God is never satisfied, and God is waiting for you to trip up so he can condemn you one more time. Once I found out that it was all him and all to his glory and all his love based on his character and nature, and that he was going to determine to save his people, the personal relationship of coming to save his own, to seek and to save that which was lost. You can only lose something that is yours. And all of that language was such a relief to me. So yeah, when I found out that he was Almighty God and I was, just to use biblical terminology, a worm, I liked that relationship. Leaving it all up to him is an enormous relief, because he doesn't change and he doesn't fail. And I fail all the time and I change constantly. So finding out that the one who is eternal and constant and rigorous had determined to save me despite myself, hooray.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I must finish this. I love your teaching. I love that the all-sovereign God is the only God that makes any sense at all. I love how you taught me that the elect Gentiles fit into God's great plan to save elect Jews. But today, and since the resurrection and baptism services of this year, and yesterday's testimony of prayer, something different happened to me. By God's amazing grace, this sinful, stupid sheep really is adopted into the family of God.
Wow.
Why do we do what we do? For emails like that. Thank you, Pastor Jim, and my deepest heartfelt thanks to everyone in the Smyrna congregation for sharing their personal stories. By my connection on the internet, I feel adopted into your family there in Tennessee. God bless you all. And finally, another email about our prayer service last week. Short and to the point. Hi, Jim. I'm listening to your message on prayer. Thank you. The feedback from the people there, it seems that others needed the guidance in this area too. I hope many others can be helped from this service today. It's too bad that the service had to end so soon. This service touched me more than any I have ever heard from GCA. So there you go.
Wow.
That's why we do what we do. Book of Acts. We are finally back where we left off. The last time we saw Paul, he was under house arrest. He'd been left in house arrest for 2 years by the governor Felix. As you may recall, Felix and the Caesar had a lot of different political problems and difficulties. Felix was ultimately taken out of his governorship, and his position was handed to a guy named Festus. We don't know a lot about Festus historically. All we know is that he was governor for just over 2 years of that area of the Middle East. And so starting in chapter 25 of the book of Acts, we're going to hear about Paul standing before Festus, and we took a lot of time this morning. We sang a lot. You know, we sang extra songs because David and Deborah are leaving us, and I'm trying to get over that. David has this wonderful opportunity to go to Florida and work with R.C. Sproul's ministry down there. And so he's going to become, as Deborah pointed out last week, she pointed to the room full of people, and she said, well, we won't be one of these people. And she pointed at the recorder up here that goes to the internet and said, we'll be one of those people. So she's joining the internet people. So for you internet people out there, you've just grown by two. But we're going to miss having you here. And so we sang some extra songs this morning and had coffee and donuts and things to say goodbye to Deborah and David. So I had promised you last week, 2 weeks ago, that we might get into some New Covenant eschatology this morning. We're going to try to get there. If we do, fine. If not, it'll keep, and we'll get into it next week. Let's see how far we get. I will warn you that I did come this morning loaded for bear, and I have nowhere to be. Yeah, exactly. And I have lots of CDs. You know, a couple weeks ago on a Wednesday night, we're going to get to the message, trust me. couple weeks ago on a Wednesday night, we were talking about gravestones. And we were talking about epitaphs and the things people write on their gravestones. And Tom suggested the epitaph for my gravestone. He said that my gravestone should say, "This was all just introduction." Chapter 25, verse 1. Now when Festus was come into the province, after 3 days he ascended from Caesarea up to Jerusalem. Then the high priest and the chief of the Jews informed Festus against Paul, and besought him and desired favor against him, that he would send for Paul to Jerusalem, and they would be laying in wait to kill him. We've seen this before. The crafty enemies of Paul tried to do this with Felix. They tried to get Felix to send Paul to Jerusalem because there were men there who would lay in wait and kill him. They need to get him out of Caesarea because there he's guarded by the Romans. But if they can get him into Jerusalem, they assume that they could actually kill him. So now Felix is gone, Festus has come in, and they think, oh, here's our opportunity again. And so they try to get Festus to send Paul back to Jerusalem. Well, of course, Paul's very aware that if he goes to Jerusalem, he is a dead man. Verse 4, but Festus answered that Paul should be kept at Caesarea and that he himself would depart shortly there. Let them, therefore, said he, which among you are able, go down with me and accuse the man if there be any wickedness in him. So when Festus has become governor, he's been handed this prisoner who's been under house arrest for 2 years, and he's never been able to determine what the crime was. And yet he inherited this prisoner. So now he's gone to Jerusalem. He's asked the leaders. The leaders have said, well, just send him to us. We'll take care of it. He wisely saw through it and said, no, you come to Caesarea and you accuse him there and we'll see what the truth of this is. Verse 6, when he had stayed among them for more than 10 days, he went down unto Caesarea. And the next day, sitting on the judgment seat, he commanded Paul to be brought. It's interesting that it says the next day. He went back to Caesarea and he got right on this. He wants to know who this prisoner is. He is a free Roman man. He is a free Roman citizen. And he's been held for 2 years so far without a substantial charge. So Festus wisely wants to get this cleared up. Verse 7, and when he was come, the Jews which had come down from Jerusalem stood round about and laid many grievous complaints against Paul, which they could not prove. Typical. Anybody here had many grievous complaints lodged against you for your Christianity? Especially when you talk about that sovereign God and that Jesus who chooses and that God who elects and foreordains before the foundation of the world. And the first thing folk will normally do is not check the text to see whether you're telling the truth. They'll just start laying grievous charges to you. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what's happening to Paul here. But they couldn't prove him. There was no proof that he had done anything actually criminal. So while he answered for himself, verse 8, he said this, neither against the law of the Jews, neither against the temple, nor yet against Caesar, have I offended anything at all. So he's gone down the list. He said, I've done nothing that is actually illegal. I've just gone into the temple and talked theology. And yet that was enough to get him shut down. Verse 9, but Festus, willing to do the Jews a pleasure, answered Paul and said, well then, will you go up to Jerusalem and there be judged of these things before me? So he wants to side with the Jews. He's the new governor. He's got to keep peace in that area. He's got one guy versus a whole nation of people. So he says, I'll tell you what, let's compromise. How about this, Paul? I'll take you down to Jerusalem and we'll have your trial there. And that way we can settle all these things. Paul knows if he goes to Jerusalem, he's in deep trouble. Then said Paul, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat, since this is a Roman governor who represents Caesar, where I ought to be judged at Caesar's seat. To the Jews I have done no wrong, as you very well know. That's a bold statement, isn't it? He tells Festus, look at the books. I've been here for 2 years. They've yet to lay a charge to me that they've been able to prove. They still haven't proven anything, and you yourself know as governor that I ought to be a free man at this moment. Verse 11, For if I be an offender, if I have committed anything worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. He said, I'm not arguing that I've done some criminal thing and now I'm trying to avoid death. He's so sure that he has not offended in any way worthy of death that he said, look, if I'm supposed to die, I'm not afraid to die. But if there be none of these things whereof these accuse me, then no man may deliver me to them. Since they have no charge against me, they can make stick. Don't you, Festus, give me to them. They'll kill me. And then he does the next wisest thing, which is to make sure he stays in the hands of the Romans, where he has a much better chance of staying alive. The end of verse 11, he says, I appeal to Caesar. Now, only a freeborn Roman citizen can do that. But now that he has, Festus has no choice but to send him up the ranks to Caesar. His problem is that when he sends him to Caesar, he has to send him with an official letter. And the official letter has to explain to Caesar why this particular prisoner is being sent to Caesar. And so far, he has nothing. He has no charge. He has nothing to write in the letter. So he's really getting concerned here. Then Festus, when he had conferred with the council, answered and said, have you appealed unto Caesar? Well then, unto Caesar you will go. Very wise move on Paul's part here. Stay in the hands of the Romans. Don't go back to Jerusalem. Now remember that he had been telling all the churches of Asia as he was traveling in his last missionary journey, he had been telling them goodbye and saying, you're never going to see my face again. And some had prophesied and said, when you go into Jerusalem, you're going to be bound and you're going to be handed over to the Gentiles. Don't go. He said he was ready to go to Jerusalem and be bound. He was ready to go to Jerusalem and die if that's what it took. And then when he got to Jerusalem and testified in the temple and was indeed bound and put into prison, Jesus shows up and says, you've testified of me in Jerusalem. You're also going to testify of me in Rome. So right at the moment that he's sitting in prison, in chains, in bondage, the strongest preacher of God's free and sovereign grace on the planet is now completely imprisoned, and Jesus shows up and says, be of good courage. This is exactly what I had planned, which is reassuring in some ways, but also disconcerting in other ways. And sometimes we go through problems in this life and think, well, where are you, God? And yet Jesus shows up and says, this was the plan, and then adds, and you're going to go to Rome. Now Paul is pressured politically because of the Jews wanting to kill him. He can't go back to Jerusalem, and he appeals through Festus to Rome, to Caesar, which is indeed going to take him to Rome, which exactly fulfills the very thing Jesus said was going to happen. Now, did Felix do exactly what Felix wanted to do? Yes. Did he imprison Paul and keep him there for a couple of years? Yeah. Is Festus doing exactly what Festus needs to do? Yeah, he's going to bind him and write a letter, and he's going to send him off to Rome and to send him to Caesar. Is Paul doing exactly what Paul's being pressured to do? Yeah, he can't go back to Jerusalem. He has to appeal to Caesar. All of these human beings are doing what they want to do, the wisest thing to do, the thing that is in their best interest. The Jews, as they're hating him and threatening to kill him, are they driving him further and further to Rome? Yes, absolutely. Is everybody doing exactly what God said was going to happen? Yeah. And they're exercising their free will, and yet through their supposed free will, they are one more time doing precisely and exactly what God and Jesus said was going to take place. And you see this repeatedly now. How many times have we seen it? Luke writing to Theophilus, a Gentile to a Gentile, consistently through this book has said, God said this was going to happen, and then people did exactly what they wanted to do, and they did exactly what God said they were going to do. This is why I'm so fond of this word compatibilism, because it is one more proof that the absolute... There's a sentence coming. This is one more proof that the absolute sovereignty of God is not in any way undermined by the choices, decisions, or actions of human beings. That was the sentence I was after. It was back here somewhere. Yeah. I'm at that age where, how many people in here remember LPs? Records, vinyl records, remember records? You have no idea what I'm talking about, do you? You don't know what a record is, do you? Do you? Okay, keep up then.
That is not a secret.
I'm so sorry. I know. I know, you're going to move back a couple rows now, aren't you? I know. You know what record, you had to put a needle on the vinyl, and if the vinyl got warped at all, the record would kind of do that. And when the record, yeah, exactly, when the record did that, the needle would skip, and it would either skip forward or backward. It'd still be the same song. It'd still be essentially the same thing, but you get this little skip, skip. My brain does that now, is the point. I get these moments where I'm right in the middle of a sentence, and I know what I'm talking about, and the needle skips, and I go, wait, there it is. So that's all you just witnessed right there, was my brain skipping. So Festus, not knowing what else to do with Paul, decides that the best move now is to send him to King Agrippa. Now, this is interesting, because he's got to deal with the fact that the charges that are being leveled against Paul are questions of the law, questions of theology, questions among the Jews, stuff that Festus simply has no knowledge of. He's just been assigned from Rome into that area, and here's this religious argument against this one guy. Well, since he doesn't know what to do about it, he decides to send Paul to Agrippa, who is part of the Herodian line, who have been ruling over the Jews, who even though they are Idumean by heritage, they have been the rulers over the Jews. Now let's talk about this lineage for a second, and you'll see the political wisdom here. There's Herod the Great. You're familiar with Herod the Great. He was the Herod during the time that Jesus was born. He's the one that built the temple that Jesus was in and that Jesus predicted the destruction of that came down in 70 AD. Herod the Great is the one who brought about the slaughter of all the children to try to kill the Christ child. That's him. Then he died while Joseph and Mary and Jesus were in Egypt. And the angel came and said, the king that seeks the child's life is dead. You can go back. His son then, Herod Antipas, became king over that area. Herod is just another name for king or ruler. So Herod Antipas comes into rulership. Now he's the one who was responsible for the beheading of John. His nephew then became the next Herod, Herod Agrippa, Agrippa the First. This is the one who killed like the apostle James. And then his son, Agrippa II, is the one we're talking about here during Paul's time, during the late 50s AD, early 60s AD. So this is Herod Agrippa II. Now, this is not a good guy, even though he is ruling over the Jews and does a lot of favors for the Jews and tries to keep peace among the Jews. His main interest is keeping peace with Rome. So he's really a puppet ruler in that area, ruling over the Jews. His consort is this woman, Bernice, we're going to hear about. This is not, by the way, his wife. This is his sister, but they are living as husband and wife. And so among the Jews, there is great outrage over this Herod Agrippa II and the fact that he and his sister consort are ruling over them. None of this is in line with or in keeping with anything that the law-keeping, moralistic Jews would consider acceptable. And yet this is the man that Paul has to go stand in front of because Festus needs something to write in his letter to Caesar. So he takes Paul to Agrippa thinking that maybe Agrippa can explain why these Jews are so upset and what Paul has done wrong so that he has something to write in his letter. Got all that? So there's a great political landscape happening here. Starting at verse 13. After certain days, King Agrippa and Bernice came unto Caesarea to salute Festus. He's the new governor, so of course the king would come down and salute him, continue to make those political alliances with Rome. Verse 14. And when they had been there many days, Festus declared Paul's cause unto the king, saying, there is a certain man left in bonds by Felix, about whom, when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews informed me, desiring to have a judgment against him. To whom I answered, it is not the manner of the Romans to deliver any man to die, before that he which is accused have the accusers face to face, and have license to answer for himself concerning the crime laid against him. Therefore, when they were come here, without any delay, on the morrow, on the next day, I sat on the judgment seat, and I commanded the man to be brought forth, against whom When the accusers stood up, they brought no accusation of such things as I supposed. This guy's been locked up for 2 years. The Jews are angry at him. The expectation Festus had was, this guy's going to be a murderer. This guy's going to be a seditionist. This guy's going to be causing riots. He's a bad guy. And then he finds out that really this is just discussions and arguments about the law of the Jews. Verse 19. But they had questions, certain questions, against him of their own superstition, and of one Jesus, which was dead, whom Paul affirmed to be alive. And because I doubted of such manner of questions, I asked him whether he would go to Jerusalem and there be judged of these matters. But when Paul had appealed to be reserved unto the hearing of Augustus, I commanded him to be kept until I might send him to Caesar. Then Agrippa said unto Festus, well, I would also hear the man myself. Tomorrow, said he, you will bring him here. So now he's going to stand before King Agrippa. Verse 23, and on the morrow, when Agrippa was come, and Bernice, with great pomp, as you might imagine, they were entered into the place of the hearing with the chief captains and the principal men of the city, and Festus commanded Paul, and he was brought forth. And Festus said, King Agrippa, and all men which are here present with us, you see this man, about whom all the multitude of the Jews have dealt with me, both at Jerusalem and also here, crying that he ought to no longer live. So they're out to kill Paul for nothing other than the proclamation that Christ was alive. Now, I keep trying to put shoe leather on this whole story. Why were they so vociferous in their argument against him? Why were they so determined not to leave Paul alone with this claim that Jesus had risen? Because if in fact Jesus had risen from the grave, their entire political structure is demolished. It all comes crashing down like a house of cards if Jesus got up. They need very badly to keep him dead. But if he got up, then everything Peter said on the day of Pentecost is true when he said, you desired a murderer and you killed the Prince of Life. Well, that's true if Jesus got up again. Jesus walked around saying things to the Pharisees like, you are whitewashed sepulchers. You look clean on the outside and inside you are full of all uncleanness and dead men's bones. If he got up again, that's true. Jesus said things like, the Father has given me power over all flesh to give life to as many as he has given me. If he got up again, that's true. Everything he said about being the Son of God and being one with God is all true if he got up again. And if that's true, then they are the children of the devil. He said, you are the children of Satan, and you will do your father's bidding. You'll do whatever your father wills. He was the father of lies. You're liars, and you seek to kill me, and you are not the sons of the prophets, because the prophets never tried to kill me. You are, in fact, the sons of those who are enemies of everything that is God. You are sons of the devil, and if he got up again, that's true. Do you see why they wanted him to stay dead? So they had two issues. One was Paul was talking about the resurrection. Among the Pharisees, they would agree, yes, the resurrection, that's true. Among the Sadducees, they would say, no, we don't believe in the resurrection. But more importantly, he's not just saying there is a resurrection. They would have been able to argue that one out for themselves. They had been for hundreds of years. But he was arguing that not only is the resurrection true, but this Jesus who you killed got up. And if that's true, he is the Son of God. He is the King of Kings. He is the Lord of Lords. And you all have no power anymore over human beings. They come to Christ and they have direct access to God, and they no longer need a priest or a high priest or a sacrifice or a temple, and your entire structure comes apart. So they have a lot of reason to want to stop this preaching.
Hey, Jim.
Yes, sir.
See if this idea ties into what you're saying. Also, I read a pastor recently say that the reason Christians suffer persecution is because when what they're doing or the message they're proclaiming is successful, in a sense. And I'm thinking of tie in, how that might tie into what you're saying here. I mean, Jesus did what he said he was going to do. He rose again. The word's going out. Disciples are being made. The thing is unfolding. It's spreading as he said it would, and as those that he sent out were proclaiming it would happen. And it wasn't enough that he himself was opposed, being a fulfillment of prophecy and all the rest by such people, but even the continuation, the unfolding, the success, the spreading of his gospel and of his kingdom just irritates the fire out of these unbelieving hearts. Mm-hmm. And it's the same way today. I mean, people want to extinguish Christians and Christianity whenever it seems to be making any progress or having any measure of success wherever it goes. That's the natural heart of men.
If it's true that Christianity sets people genuinely free, because there is no greater sense of freedom than that freedom, like we talked earlier, that freedom of guilt, freedom from bondage, the freedom of knowing that you are accepted by the God of ages, well, then you're not afraid of this life and you're not afraid of death. And when you have that kind of freedom, nobody can do anything to you. The worst they can do to you is kill you and send you home.
Yeah.
That's the worst they can do to you. So then they can't control you. And human beings, by their natural fleshly ego, love to control other human beings. As long as there have been humans, there's been murder and war. Bloodshed for control. That's the natural human instinct. So you're right. On one side, from the humanistic side, they hate genuine Christianity because it gives people the independence to go to God on their own and they don't live in fear. And if you can't make people fearful, you can't control people. The other place where anti-genuine Christianity sentiment comes from. Was that a sentence? Was that even close to a sentence? The other area that you see opposition to genuine Christianity, there's a better phrase, is from religious circles that want to use religion to control you. Because it's just another mode and another method of controlling people. Building larger buildings and greater edifices and more political power and having more people in our group and all that kind of stuff. And when you preach the genuine gospel of freedom in Christ, the Son will set you free. Those that the Son sets free are free indeed. And you can go to God on your own and you don't need an intercessor and you don't need a pope and you don't need a preacher and you don't need a confessor and, you know, and you don't need anybody between you and God. You already have it. You have the one who ever lives to make intercession for us sitting at the right hand of God. When you have that, then religion can no longer control you. So religion hates that. So really, genuine Christianity gets opposition from every corner. All man-made religion hates the notion of individual freedom. And yet Christianity says you have the individual right to go to God crying, Abba, Father, at the throne of grace. You have an intercessor and you have the right to go pray to God one-on-one and he hears you individually because he loves you, because he wants to love you, because you are his child, his son, you're adopted. All of that great language that is personal language about you and your relationship with God. Religion doesn't like that because they want to be the arbiter to keep people from God so that they can say the only way to get to God is through us, through our religion, through our denomination, through our temple, through our book, through our whatever their thing is.
That's a good point, because the greatest opposition Paul is facing
is religious.
Is the religious Jews.
Right. So instead, you know, I stand up here, little bald guy standing out here in Smyrna, crying out there on the internet saying to people, whom the Son sets free is indeed and in fact free. And you have the freedom to go to God individually and personally and talk to him about everything. And you have the individual right and freedom to go to God knowing that he accepts you and he loves you personally and individually. And that he knew you before the foundation of the world, that he wrote your name in a book. That's how personal it is. And that nobody and nothing can get between that relationship that you have with God. And like I said, the worst anybody can do to you is just send you home to be with the one who ever loved you. You can't control people like that. And so I'm out here trying to set people free and saying, The only person who controls you is God, who knows your heart and your will and conscience and put his Holy Spirit inside you. Let that be the restraining force in your life and throw off the shackles of religion. Throw off the bondwoman and her child. I think we talked about that recently on a Wednesday. The Bible is chock full of this language. All I'm doing is standing up here reciting and indeed plagiarizing what is in the Bible, and it sounds so foreign to people when I say it because they've been raised in this oppressive religion. But the truth of the matter is, people hate Christianity, or they adore Christianity. I'm in the I love and adore genuine Christianity camp, and that means I am largely hated by the world and by religion. But that's okay. I'm not seeking their approval anyway. The only person I want to approve what I'm doing is the master of everything.
Amen.
And if he accepts me, I'm accepted. So, you had your hand up for a moment.
Yeah, when the veil in the temple was torn, it was, of course, torn from top to bottom,
right.
Not like a person going around ripping something.
Right.
It was God providing, there is no...
A curtain that was a foot thick,
yeah,
torn from top to bottom.
I'm talking about Kleenex here.
No, right, exactly.
Not only was it torn, but it couldn't be hidden that it happened.
Right.
Some one of those priests, it was like they couldn't deny. That was a very visible, miraculous
Absolutely.
Event that they couldn't hide from.
Right. When you put that together with the earthquakes, the 3 hours of darkness, the veils torn open, they knew that something had occurred special.
Something had happened, and then once that is torn, the whole infrastructure is right. No longer needed. Because there is no need to have that whole cast of people.
Right. High priest wasn't needed.
That do all that. And
well, now think the rest of the way, Mike, because you bring up a very interesting point, and long as you've brought it up, and because I'm willing to chase tangents, was the Ark of the Covenant inside Herod's temple?
No.
No. So what was inside that Holy of Holies?
Nothing.
It was like pulling back the curtain and finding out that the great and powerful Oz was in fact a guy with levers.
That was a good analogy.
They ripped open, God ripped open the curtain and showed that the holiest place, which is where God met with the high priest once a year for forgiveness of sins for Israel exclusively, again, exclusive people being forgiven in the act of the high priest. That was a particular intercessory work, but there was no Ark of the Covenant there. It had disappeared during the Babylonian captivity. It hadn't been found since, hasn't been found to this day, despite Steven Spielberg's claims to dig it up. It's still not found anywhere, which means that when it was torn open, several things were being said. One is, look, there's no Ark of the Covenant in here, so there, not only is there no need for the high priest, there's no place for the high priest to come intercede. Because the real high priest is on his altar shaped like a cross out there outside the gates of Jerusalem. And when he died, he did the intercessory work once for all, thereby perfecting forever those that are sanctified, all of that language in the book of Hebrews. So there's a lot of stuff going on. And of course, there are many people who argue that, the curtain was torn because Jesus' death freed God now to go out to the Gentiles. So it tore the curtain to let God out. And I say, no, it was torn to let us in. It was to say, look, there's nothing here. There's no Ark of the Covenant. There's no high priest. This entire sacrificial system is now empty.
A shadow anymore.
It's not even a shadow anymore. It's been fulfilled. It's done. And so what did the Jews do about the torn curtain?
Sewed it up.
Got right to work sewing it up. Got right. Let's. Guys, sewing machine. Big sewing machine. Let's go. Knitting, sewing. Because they had to try to keep the image alive. They had to keep the facade alive. And that's what they're doing here with Paul. Paul's running around saying, he's raised. He died, Paul's theology, he died for our offenses and he was raised for our justification. If that's true, then all those that he died for are not only forgiven for their sins, but they are justified in the resurrection. So they've got to stop this resurrection stuff. Because if justification comes through Christ, then there's no point to the priesthood. No more animals, no more blood, no more sacrifice, no more Kapareth, no more covering, no more ark, no more, we got to stop this. And I'm sure that at some point in history, some priest somewhere went, ah, I'm sure that that... never mind.
Well, there's also no more gravy trains.
Yeah. No doubt. No doubt. Because they made their wealth off the gifts that were brought to the temple. And they ate off the sacrificial gifts and the tithes and offerings. If that comes to a close, if that comes to an end, yeah, shut down the soup kitchen.
Buffet's closed.
Over. Yes, absolutely. And Festus said... Verse 24, and Festus said, King Agrippa, and all the men that are here present with us, you see this man, about whom all the multitude of the Jews have dealt with me, both at Jerusalem and also here, crying that he ought to no longer live. But when I found that he had committed nothing worthy of death, and that he himself had appealed to Augustus Caesar, I have determined to send him, of whom I have no certain thing to write to my lord. Wherefore, I've brought him forth before you, and especially you, O King Agrippa, that after examination is had, I might have something to write. For it seemeth to me unreasonable to send a prisoner, and not withal to signify the crimes against him.
Yep.
Yeah? He's appealed to Caesar, I have to send him to Caesar now, but I don't know what to write about it, so I brought him to you specifically, because you have a history with the Jews, and you're going to have more knowledge of what this whole argument is about. So chapter 26 begins, then Agrippa said unto Paul, you are permitted to speak for yourself. Then Paul stretched forth his hand and answered for himself, saying, I think myself happy, King Agrippa, because I shall answer for myself this day before thee, touching all the things whereof I am accused of the Jews, especially because I know you to be an expert in all the customs and questions which are among the Jews. Wherefore I beseech you to hear me patiently. My manner of life from my youth, which was at the first among my own nation at Jerusalem, that know all the Jews. In other words, he's saying, they've known me since I was a child. I grew up in Jerusalem. They know the manner of life I've had. They know that I was raised in the strictest of the Jewish religion. Verse 5, and they know that from the beginning, if they would testify, that after the most straitest sect of our religion, I lived a Pharisee. So his argument is, if they're going to charge me with something, they also ought to admit that I know their religion as well as they do. And I have been zealous for the law. I have been blameless before the law. And now I stand and am judged. Look at this phrase. This is a fascinating phrase. For the hope of the promise made of God unto our fathers. One more time, Paul is going to connect the resurrection of Christ to the history of Judaism, reaching all the way back to Abraham. And this is another one of those wonderful providential moments where our Wednesday night teaching and Sunday morning teaching intersects. Because we've been talking a lot about the Abrahamic covenant as we've been working our way through Genesis on Wednesday nights. So most of you should be very familiar with this idea that there was a promise made to the forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And Paul is saying, I was raised a strict Jew. I was raised a Pharisee, and the only thing I'm accused of at this moment is believing the promise made by God to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So he's going to connect the preaching of Christ and the resurrection to the Abrahamic covenant. Isn't this wonderful? You know, I have said time and time again that if I did not worship the God of this Bible, I would have to worship the men who figured out how to write it. Because the theology is so brilliant. If you can read this Bible and see now connections between the book of Acts and the book of Genesis and how it's going to flow for a moment, we're going to take a couple of little side trips as we work our way through the rest of Paul's sermon here, and you're going to see how it all ties together so beautifully and interweaves. If you can't see the hand of God in this, you're just not looking. I'm very, very close to finished. Because there's no way I'm going to get into all the stuff I want to get into. And which I will get into, because nobody can stop me.
No.
But not today. I stand and am judged for the hope of the promise made of God unto our fathers, unto which promise our 12 tribes, instantly serving God day and night, hope to come. For which hope's sake, King Agrippa, I am accused of the Jews. Why would it be thought a thing incredible with you that God should raise the dead? I verily thought with myself that I ought to do many things contrary to the name of Jesus Christ. He's saying, I myself, being a Pharisee, growing up, I persecuted Christianity. Which thing I also did in Jerusalem, verse 10, and many of the saints did I shut up in prison, having received authority from the chief priests. And when they were put to death, I gave my voice against them, and I punished them often in every synagogue, and I compelled them to blaspheme. And being exceedingly mad against them, I persecuted them even unto strange cities, whereupon I was on my way to Damascus with authority and a commission from the chief priests. You know this story. He's going to tell it again. And Luke is going to recite it again, that he was riding on his donkey in the middle of the day when this bright light knocked him down and converted him instantaneously with no act of the will and no choice. God chose him and said, you are a chosen vessel unto me. We'll get into that next week. What I want to spend some time on is the phrase, I stand here and am judged for the hope of the promise made to God unto our fathers, unto which promise our 12 tribes, instantly serving God day and night, hope to come. Hope to come, still hope to come. 12 tribes, hope to come. By the time Paul is writing this, the northern tribes have disappeared essentially to history since the time of the Assyrian captivity. By the time of Cyrus allowing the Jews to go back and rebuild the temple and freeze the Israelite slaves, by that time the northern area of Canaan had been occupied. They had no place to go back to, essentially. And so from that point forward, those northern tribes, Israel, the northern 10 tribes known as Israel and Ephraim, disappear essentially to the historic record, and they're known as the lost tribes. And yet when Jesus walked the planet, he said to his apostles, go first to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And he said that while he was walking among the house of Judah. Go first to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, preaching the gospel of the kingdom. Meaning that they were findable. They existed somewhere. They were available. Now, Paul gets all of his theology out of the Old Testament. And here Paul is saying, even after the cross, even after the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ, that the promises made to Abraham are still so prominent, so coexistent, that the hope made to those fathers is still the hope of the 12 tribes. Where does he get that? How can he say that the 12 tribes, though the northern tribes are still scattered, yet hope in the resurrection to come? Where does he get that? I'll see you next Sunday.
On behalf of everyone at Grace Christian Assembly, we thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. Remember to visit us on the internet at www.salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.